So today's session is on gaming and location. What that means, we don't know yet. We'll start talking it through and hopefully have a good discussion, then open it up to Q&A at the end. To start off, we're going to let each kind of panelist go through and then maybe do just like, you know, 5 minutes, show a few slides, different games they've done, different experiences they've had, and go from there. You want to start?
Sure. Yeah, hi. My name's Jeremy Irish. I'm the founder of geocaching.com and the president and CEO of groundspeak.com, which is a company that manages the website.
I don't think you're...
You hear me? No, I got it. So how many people know about geocaching? How many have gone geocaching? Okay, cool. I'll just give a little background about geocaching for those who aren't aware of it, or aware of it for the first time. Geocaching was started in May of 2000. There's actually a plaque at the original location where the cache is located. That's how insane the community is, that they kind of honor it with that plaque. Basically what happened was selective availability was removed in 2000. This took GPS technology and made the accuracy of GPS from 300 feet to about 20 feet. And as a result, a guy by the name of Dave Ulmer actually placed a container out in the woods. It was a gallon container buried up to its neck, had a can of beans in it, a movie and a logbook, and said, if you find this, take an item, leave an item, and write in the logbook. And it was found, I think, 2 days later by Mike Teague. And he started a website just managing all the new caches that were being listed through a news group. I found out about it three months later, went out, convinced my wife to buy a GPS unit so I could do this. Had probably the worst hiking experience I've ever had. I was unprepared and I went up a clear cut and it was the hottest day. I had no bug spray and no water. Got to the top of the mountain and, which I didn't know was a mountain at the time, so it took me a while to get there. There was a stump, and right behind the stump was this 3x5 card box. Had a Sunny Delight drink in it, which is why we have a rule, no food in caches. A disposable camera and a logbook. And the experience of finding that, I was so elated that I was able to find this thing and that I was able to use this technology to locate treasure in the real world, that when I was coming down the hill, I thought, you know, boy, it'd be great if I was more prepared. And so if I could create a website that would make people more prepared and get people more involved with this, then I'm doing a good thing. So it was pretty much a hobby for about 2 years. Another thing is that that original can of beans, when this plaque was first mounted, was actually found, buried. Let me see if I can get the... I'm the only one with the PC on this panel, and it's probably not going to work. There you go. This is the OCB, or the original can of beans. It was actually recovered by the guy who's placing the plaque. He put it in this beautiful case and has protected it for the last, I think, 4 or 5 years, and he takes it to events. So he's very proud of his find. This is just a map of Austin and gives you an idea how many caches are actually out there. There are over 500,000 caches in the world today. And we get about 5,600 new caches a week, to give you an idea. There's over a million active participants in the activity, and we think there's about 3 million people that actually participate. There are different types of icons because there are different types of caches. If you're interested in knowing more about it, you can go to the website. These are the types of containers people hide based on where you are. You're not going to put an ammo can in the middle of the city for obvious reasons. And usually we try to get people to do clear Tupperware containers. A lot of people use lock and locks, and then these are the kind of toys that you see in caches, different styles. Usually it's a different demographic than I think the rest of the panel. Usually families with kids, around 38 years of age, with kids between the ages 6 and 12. Younger kids play, but it ranges the gamut. And the big question we ask is how we make money. We sell travel bugs, not this size, but they're basically tracking numbers that go on these tags, and then people can... put them in caches and they track from place to place. And kind of a low-tech tracking system on the website. We also sell tracking numbers for geocoins, and you can see on eBay there's 864 for sale right now. I just took the screenshot. And then we also provide premium features that allows you to take the data and put it into devices like the Garmin Colorado. I don't want to take up too much time. basically we're going from geocaching to other kinds of experiences, more around adventure gaming, Zork type experiences where you overlay areas in real space and then create virtual objects and characters that you can interact with through a handheld device. We're coming from the side of a using GPS and not using mobile phones, so it's interesting to see the convergence.
Cool.
So it works.
Thanks. My name is Will Carter, and I'm not really affiliated, but I'm really into this idea of pervasive electronic games, and so this is just a comment on one of the games I made from GameTrailers.com, which was kind of funny, but anyway. So I'm really into this idea of pervasive electronic games, and you know, games that that follow you into the real world, while at the same time really allowing you to break away from it. So being able to duck into a virtual world just during the course of your normal day and then kind of get sucked into the world and come out. It can be a 5-minute experience, 10-minute experience, whatever. So one of the games that I've worked with that deals a lot with this is this game called Mob Zombies, which we showed a little bit here last year. Mob Zombies is basically a relative positioning game. So you use a handheld device, and as you move around, your movement in the physical world controls the movement of a character in the virtual world. So if I take a step forward, the character takes a step forward. If I turn left or right, the character moves left and right. So, and what I mean by a relative positioning system, unlike geocaching or a lot of location-based stuff, it doesn't actually use GPS coordinates. It puts you in positions you in a virtual space, and then uses your movement in the physical space to translate into the virtual world. So it's basically like being a human joystick. So players basically walk around, and what they see is like this little zombie character. Sorry, this is a little small, but the resolution is not great. But as you move around, you create you control the little character there on the bottom with the pink brain, and you basically run away from zombies. And so we wanted to create a real simple game that essentially, the whole point was just running away and really using the mobile platform and this kind of idea of playing a game in a real space and make it really about interacting with the physical space as well as virtual space. So it kind of has that idea of being pervasive because you can jump into this virtual world at any point and play a game, run away from zombies, jump back out, the zombies aren't there anymore, etc. You can blow them up with bombs and things like that. So we use this really, really wonky thing that we had last year. It was like this thing that airport security really didn't like very much, especially flying to New York. I think it was the battery hanging off there. But it was just basically a prototype device. We had used a Sony Vaio, and we used accelerometers and this digital compass that's like totally hacked in there somewhere. So this is kind of the version one device. And so, but we demonstrated it a few times, and we got a lot of really great feedback. And I think it really comes down to this idea of being able to facilitate people wandering, so that you can kind of duck into this virtual world, and you kind of have this experience, and you get spit back out. I mean, with this device, we showed it with at the Wired Next Fest, and which was cool because it's a lot of kids that come through there, and they don't really have any expectations about what the game's going to be or whatever, and they just got totally absorbed with it, and that they would oftentimes start the game then. And just wander and then get spit back out, and they were somewhere else in the convention center or this kind of stuff. And I think one of the advantages of the relative positioning systems is that it really allows you to play anywhere. There's no constraints. It's just wherever you can go. So anyway, that's the wandering stuff. But we also wanted to basically move this forward a little bit, make it a little more accessible than this other device. So we started building this. The rest of the people on my team, Julian Bleeker and Aaron Myers, started building this the version one of the sort of new version, whatever that means, which is basically this totally standalone device. And if anybody wants to see it, I have it right here. We have a little enclosure for it, but it's essentially allows you to play these games on mobile phones. So what it does is it actually is totally just contained and self-contained in this little thing. communicates your relative position information through Bluetooth to a phone, and then you can play the game on the phone. So I think what we're trying to do is facilitate these kind of like, you know, arcade-style games, or these kind of just playful, fun virtual games that you can run around with, play on your phone. I think that some of the other stuff we're looking into that we can probably talk more about in this panel is. Oh, can you not hear me?
You need to start over.
Did anybody get any of that? I can hear myself pretty well.
It sounded great from up here.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, that's really all.
It's really important stuff.
Yeah. So moving forward, I think one of the things we can talk about in the panel is just this idea of relative positioning versus, you know, absolute positioning. And we've been thinking about, with this game, taking it to a place where essentially, you know, people on the web or people using, you know, various locative absolute positioning systems can, you know, lay maps or lay items out for somebody that's playing the game in the virtual world, and we can actually, using the phone version, we can grab your absolute position to kind of start you off, and then populate the game world with objects that are coming in from, you know, wherever, from people that are placing them, you know, at you know, some places in New York or whatever, so that when you start the game, your character and all the world items are kind of built there for you, and then you can play around. But that's just something we can talk about a little more in the panel. So that's it for me.
Do we need to switch here?
No, I'm good.
What are you?
I have no idea. No. I'm whatever Jeremy
Try them all.
Who are you?
I was one.
Four plus
two. Yeah, thank
you. One. Right.
You are?
No.
I promise.
Give some time. Give some time.
Oh, okay. I'm impatient. And inaudible.
Leopard. Let's see if this works. Hey. Hi, my name is Michael Sharon. I'm the co-founder of a company called Socialite, and we do build an urban navigation service for the real world, so we help people discover places around them, tag secret bars for friends, all sorts of other things. And so the core of the system is built on virtual sticky notes, which we let people put up anywhere and write anything they want, and then kind of share it in any way they want. So some of the things they write are stuff like... Oh, too much. One more. So it's stuff like, where can I find some good food? Where's some great coffee? What's going on around here? All of that kind of stuff. I've also been sharing office space with this company called Area Code, which does location-based games for the last 3 years. And so I've worked on or played a lot of the games that they've built. And so location is very close to my heart, but I'm not going to be talking at all about Socialite today. I'm going to start off talking about Conquest. So this is a game I worked on. I worked on the second version of this. Dennis Crowley worked on the first one. Conquest was a scavenger hunt game played in cities around the U.S. Consisted of five teams, 25 kids per team, and it had these five giant inflatable animal totems that each team had. And the way it worked is each city was divided into eight different zones, and you had to check into the zone and then collect some treasure. And so what was the treasure? The treasure was these things called semicodes, two-dimensional barcodes. And so it was based, the concept of the game was based on the idea of an open secret. You play a game where you put these codes out into the real world, and everybody can see them, and they're actually part of the fabric of the real world at specific places. But if you're in the game, then you know what's going on. So it's similar to geocaching, but with a large barcode in all sorts of surfaces to remind you that, yes, you're playing the game. And so they did crazy things because they had a great budget for the game. So they did things like big media buys. You saw the billboard right up front. They even did like some bus stops. One of my favorite things from the game is this ad. So they made a fake ad and embedded semicode inside the ad. The ad is for some fragrance called Moi. It smells so good you'll fall in love with yourself. And so the kids really got into the game, and you started seeing them running around the cities and trying to discover these codes in any location. And really, the codes were everywhere. I think for one city, it even printed them out on plastic bags, and they hung it in the back of a shop. That's just a little bit of the admin. That's what the messages looked like. And so when you got an SMS during the game, it would tell you a little bit about where each team was, which zone each team was, and how many points they had. It's a little bit of what it looked like. So we were stuck in HQ most of the time, so we didn't get to see this, but this is a nice tall hotel room. So we could see the kids actually picking up these animals, running to a different zone, taking a picture of the Semicode to check it into the zone, and then moving through to take a picture of the other Semicode treasures. Giant animals in the streets. And so you really started to get a sense of how interested the kids were in the game when they prepared ahead of time. And then they would come to the games with these things like chain of commands, military-style chain of commands, call signs for every single person. And so to encourage that and to encourage the kind of the team spirit, they did things like give out little tattoos that you could put on, relate to your animal. And so the next game that we worked on with Area Code was a game for UbiComp, the Ubiquitous Computing Conference in Japan. It was called Superstar Tokyo. This game was interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was based on Purikura, which is the print club, which was all the rage in Japan a couple of years ago, where you'd go into these little booths and take a picture of yourself with some Hawaiian sunset in the background. And so we decided this would be great to play a game with, and so we created this game where you took one of these star cards that we gave out, went into the booth, took a picture of yourself, and then the idea was that you would stick these stickers all around the city, and people would go to those places and then take a picture of that, and at some stage your picture would get taken so many times you'd become a superstar. How did it work? Well, it's just simple pyramid scheme points. You take a picture of somebody else's picture and you get 100 points, and then later on anything else they take a picture of, you also get 100 points. And so the interesting thing about this game is that in terms of location, it was restricted to places where you could see the stickers, and in terms of starting the game, it was restricted to booths, so booths where you could actually go and take your picture. And so there are a couple of interesting issues with that, because if you didn't have easy access to it, then it was a bit of a problem. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later, and I'm going to switch over to Dennis's presentation. Sweet. All right.
It's going to slide over, I think?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll go like this.
Oh, well done. Do I get the whole two-screen thing? That's
awesome. Yeah. Yeah. It's super fancy.
Seats or?
Nah, go for it.
Hi. Can you guys hear me? Good. My name's Dennis. I've been doing location-based stuff for almost like 2008, like 8 years now, it seems. I used to work on for a company called Vindigo. So I've never used Vindigo back in the day. It's like one of the first location-based services, I think, that real people started using without GPS. Like a city guide that worked on Palm Pilots. And then after that, I was working on a project called Dodgeball with my buddy Alex in the back. Hey, dude, what's up? Has anyone ever used Dodgeball before or is using it here? Oh, sweet. Thanks for using it. And so, you know, Vindigo was a tool to help you navigate your cities based upon geolocation. Like, I tell it I'm at this, you know, the corner of such and such, and it tells me the nearest bars and restaurants that are nearby. And what we were trying to do with Dodgeball is, you know, you tell it where you are at a specific venue name, and then it alerts all your friends to your presence, and it helps bring all these, like, you know, ad hoc flash mobs together on the fly. So I've been really into the geo stuff for a while. And then while I was at NYU, they have this program called ITP, where I was at, where the Dodgeball stuff came out of. I also got a chance to work on this project called Pac-Manhattan. Has anyone seen this thing either? This comes up, it's just never dies, this project. Like a bunch of us, like grown men running around in Pac-Man suits, like you want it to go away, but it doesn't. And so Pac-Manhattan was one of the first examples of like a big urban game, you know, like a street game that was played where, you know, it's like us running around, you know, playing a game of tag in the streets, dressed up, trying to mimic Pac-Man, but there was a bunch of technology involved where there was, you know, people running in the street and then people watching from above, you know, in constant communication with cell phones, you know, just kind of coordinating back and forth. So I'm going to assume that some people have seen this stuff before. But the idea here is that, you know, I've just been hooked on the idea of like, of doing some of the stuff with street games as well as applying the stronger geolocative technology to it to make it a little bit more interesting. Mike shares office space at a company called Area Code. I was working with them for the last year or so on a couple games that I'll show you right now. One of them was Plunder. Has anyone ever played Plunder or seen Plunder? Oh, sweet. Hey, how are you? So Plunder's a game.
So that's
Thanks
him.
Thanks for coming up. Yeah. You know, Plunder's, it was a game that's built off of, did you even introduce yourself as Skyhook and the stuff that you guys
do? I was going to do at the end, yeah.
You're going to do that afterwards?
Come back around, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
save the best
you know,
for
Ryan
last.
Works for a company that makes some great geolocative technology. There's a plugin called Loki that allows you to get location out of a browser. And Plunder's a game that lets you search for Wi-Fi hotspots in your area. And whenever you discover one of these hotspots, you can create an island around it. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of them in Austin, which kind of bums me out. But we created one real quick. This is Ryan Sarver's Island of Dreamy Panelist. And so if anyone was to load this game up and play this and try to connect to the Wi-Fi here, they would instantly be on my island. And on that island, they can start to buy and sell these goods back and forth. So certain islands have things like, you know, bananas or pepper or whatnot, and certain islands don't have these items or have other things. And so the idea is that by just imagine this map having a whole bunch of islands around it, like downtown Manhattan. I know, sorry.
We're going to run around and make a bunch, but...
Yeah, I just have photoshopped it up together. But by traveling from one hotspot to the next, you're actually, like, trading these goods back and forth. So it's, you know, it takes some of these, you know, item commodity type of trading games, but then applies this geolocation to it, where in order to trade the goods, you're actually moving from one physical location to the next, which is kind of interesting. It gets people up and moving and using... you know, using their laptops in ways, I guess, like with geolocative stuff in ways they haven't done before. And one of the interesting things is the way it was built, it's you know, it's running worldwide. So again, here's a sad little island in the middle of Japan somewhere. Man, I should have a slide here with a whole bunch of islands on it. And then, you know, looking at like where geolocative stuff is going in the future, we started thinking about like what other devices can you port this to? And you know, it's kind of a drag sometimes to pull out your laptop and open it up and connect to the Starbucks Wi-Fi and pay the $7. But there's other devices out there that can snip this type of stuff that it's not as much of a commitment to continue to play. Nintendo DS is like a great example of that. There hasn't really been a lot of location-aware development for the DS. It's because I think Nintendo is a little bit shy of it. But it's definitely one of those platforms to look at going forward. I think what we're going to talk about in this panel some is just how difficult it is to build a lot of these location-aware games. And, like, the DS is no exception to that, and it's really difficult to build them on mobile phones. Like, the mobile phone is kind of like the default example of where you would want to build this stuff. But it's just so hard to develop for and get access to the network and whatnot. And just like one other example is another game that Area Code created called Crossroads, which was, actually this is a little bit better, but it's more like, it's almost like taking the Pac-Manhattan stuff, which is a little bit of like an urban street chase where you're playing against someone else, and making it rely a little bit more on technology, or geolocative technology. So this is running on Boost mobile phones that actively have a GPS fix. The grid that you see here is this particular grid in Manhattan. So it goes from like West 10th Street down. This is way over in the West Village for people that aren't familiar. And the idea is that you're playing, it's a one-on-one game, where you're, you know, one team is the sun, which I think you can see, it might be behind one of these icons, and the other team is the moon, and the idea is to run around and kind of flip the intersections over, a little bit like Othello. Like if I stand in the intersection for 10 seconds, you can see the little 10-second countdown over here, it flips it from one color to the next. And you know, it's got this interesting aesthetic where you're running around, you see where the other players are, and you start like running towards them or running away from them. This game was interesting because it had an added element, like an NPC, a non-playing character, that little skull up there that doesn't exist in the game, but follows you around. And when it catches up with you, it takes away some of your points. So, like, you're looking at this, you know, at your device that has the map on it, and you know, it's like, okay, you can see where you you can look up and see the person that you're playing against on the map, and then maybe look up and see them running past you. But then, you know, you have the same type of reaction when you look at the you know, the non-player character. So you're looking at it, it's like, you know, oh shit, it's coming towards me, but then you look up and there's nothing there. So you're being chased by nothing. And like you're literally running away from it on the street, and I don't know, it's just kind of an interesting experience that some of this stuff kind of fosters. Just real quick, was anyone here last year for this panel? There was, yeah, like a locative games panel. And this is, you know, the dirty secret here is it's like, it's some of these slides will look familiar because not too much has changed in the last, I don't know, in the last year or so that enables people to build games that were better than they were like a year ago. Everyone's talking about the iPhone SDK, and I think we're going to talk about it here. And I'm not particularly super as psyched about it as we should be, I guess. It's because it doesn't change the game in a lot of great ways. I mean, like some of the stuff, I'm going to flip through these real quick for some of the folks who were here last year, but like some of the stuff that really excites me is like this Nike Plus stuff where, you know, anyone ever used Nike Plus? Where you attach it to your shoe and you put it on your iPod and you're running every day and it's tracking where you're going. But then you can start competing against people. So automatically you have this incentive to get out of bed in the morning where it's like, if I don't run, someone else is going to run. They're going to get in front of me. You know, you've got this persistent game that's going on. Nike's been doing some interesting stuff where you can take these runs and start graphing them out, like making these social graphs. And a lot of people are participating in this. Like, hey, here's my 5-mile run. Here's my 2-mile run. If like you're training for a 5K or something, these things turn out to be very, very helpful. You know, this is the Williamsburg Bridge. I was walking down it one day and I saw a piece of graffiti like this, like spray painted right in the bike lane. And like the, you know, I was just like, why can't you run over that and get points for it, you know? And so like I started looking around and you know, I saw a couple these other examples of these. Like they're not connected to anything, but it's just kind of like, you know, it's like street art in random places, like supposed to be nostalgic, but why can't that be a game board? Like why can't I take this, you know, this route that I would run, I've never run this route, by the way, but why can't I take this route and like drop power-ups over it and get credit for it? Because I'm like, maybe I'm competing with my friends for time and like to see who can run the most, but maybe there's an incentive for me to get out of bed 45 minutes earlier because I can pick up more coins than the other person. I've been trying to extend this stuff to like to skiing also, you know, where it's like not to Super Mario powers, but maybe like you pick up missiles and bombs and stuff. And this is something I talked about last year, and I plugged away on it for you know, a couple months, but it was very, it's just, it's hard to build this stuff because the devices that you want to take with you when you're running out and being active aren't necessarily the devices that are connected to the network or the ones that can do all the geolocative stuff. So just it's a real pain in the ass to build. And like some of the newest, like the iPhone SDK doesn't solve a lot of these problems. Like it gets more people thinking about them and more people using it, but it doesn't necessarily solve some of this stuff. Just two things I've seen real quick that are kind of interesting. I was just out skiing at like Beaver Creek, this like ritzy resort in Colorado, and like they sell these, they lease these like little mini GPS devices, like the kind that you'd put in your car, like a TomTom, that's built for the, you know, built just for the ski, for ski trails, right? So you can pan around and zoom, and there's another, I don't have the thing here, but it gives you directions like, I'm trying to find my way to the lodge, so, you know, take a left at the next trail, then take a right here. I mean, obviously someone just took the basic rules behind the TomTom and just added another map on top of it. But if people are carrying this type of stuff, and it's like if people are repurposing existing like geolocative tools to do, you know, for like skiing uses or for navigating cities and stuff, like more handheld rather than, you know, rather than like driving around usage, like you can see people building games on top of this. And then one last thing, Blast Theory, like an arts collective out in the UK, did this thing called Riderspoke, and I never got to play this, which I kind of regret. But this woman is kind of a lousy picture too. But she's on a bike, and she's got one of these Nokia, like I think like 800s or whatever, attached to the handlebars. And as she's riding around, it's got a map that's, you know, positioning different things, like annotating. Oh, this is, I think it's more like a historical tour. Like this is something that's happening, you know, two blocks ahead of you. Maybe you should go over here. It's like a city guide that's attached to the bike. But there's no reason why that also can't be a map that looks like this, that allows you to drive around and pick up other things. You know, it's just like, it's exciting to think about people taking some of this existing, you know, like some of the devices that are getting a little bit smarter, some of the more location-aware devices, and building more game-like applications on top of them. And so that's just some of the slides I have. So, thank you.
Cool.
Sorry, applause. And as Dennis said, my name is Ryan Sarver. I work for a company called Skyhook Wireless, and we do Wi-Fi positioning. So we're kind of an enabler of some of these different technologies, not in all cases, but we're a GPS-like technology. And I think one of the interesting things is we can start enabling location on devices where it didn't exist, where GPS might not exist. Laptops, Nintendo DS, PSP, that type of stuff. So I'll try and stay out of the way today and let these guys talk, but hopefully it helps give a little background. So I want to take a quick survey and kind of figure out, you know, where everyone in the audience is coming from. Who here is a game developer or has done game development? Designers. And the one we're coining today, and you can write it down, who's geo-curious? All right, great. So that gives us a good background. So I think the, you know, one of the interesting things, right, it's probably very timely to start talking about it, but how does the iPhone and, you know, the accessibility of geolocation change the way that some of these games start working? I think Dennis has voiced his opinion. I think we can maybe go down, you know, Will's, where, you know, he's doing more relative location, it might not matter as much, but the geolocation guys like Jeremy, you know, what does it mean to you, and how does it change, you know, the availability?
Well, I'm waiting until the iPhone actually has GPS in it. That's why I'm hesitating. I think there are a couple things I wanted: 3G, access to Exchange, and then GPS. I think GPS will probably be one of the next generation devices. Maybe they're just waiting for the next big thing so they can tout that as they come out with, you know, GPS technology on the phone. Relative positioning, or using Wi-Fi access spots as kind of this amorphous blob when you get a location based on that information. So you really can't sort of direct yourself with an arrow to a location. It's very good for other types of location-based games, but geocaching in particular, it's very difficult to use. Although in sort of an adventure game scenario, and I didn't bring up where I go, but it's a new concept to work working on that sort of takes Zork and brings it out into the real world. You can use those Wi-Fi access points as rooms that you can put objects and characters in and solve puzzles and that sort of thing. And I think with Wi-Fi positioning, it's something that you could certainly do. So the ability of having that on today's phone really is, you know, interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd love to look into that more.
Well, I think, you know, to Dennis's point a little bit, you know, there's not much has changed in even not just the past 1 year, but the past, you know, 10 years in terms of location accessibility. You know, what is, even though the accuracy might not be the same, but what does the accessibility on a device like that mean for location-based games? Are we going to see more casual location-based games? Is it going to change drastically, not change at all? You know, Will, what do you think?
Well, I mean, for the iPhone, I think that the thing for me is, like, I think it would work really well for games where you kind of do check-ins on your location. I think, like, Plunder, for example, or whatever. But they also lock down, I mean, certain things, like, for our game, I mean, it's like they lock down, I think, like, probably access to Bluetooth. Correct me if I'm wrong. But you can't do a lot of peripheral-based stuff, and you can use, you know, the location stuff, you can't, you know, be updating, like, you can't have an app that's updating your location in the background. You'd have to be doing it all through the one app. And, I mean, I don't know. I think that it'd be interesting to see. I think you're also, like, it kind of brings up the idea of, like, fuzzy location and how you deal with that in games. I mean, a lot of these games, like, deal a lot with, like, pretty absolute position. Like, even within, you know, 5-10 meters, you know, you're pretty good. And so how do you kind of use the fuzziness of the current? I mean, because sometimes it's fuzzy, sometimes it's not, right? Mm. And so how do you kind of deal with that resolution or the granularity of the location information to create, you know, to kind of add that to the game mechanics? And I think that, I mean, that's potentially an opportunity to figure out, you know, how you can use kind of fuzzy location to do stuff. I mean, so I think that certainly I'm looking forward to, you know, tinkering around with it and just taking it as a constraint. And I think those are always good things to actually make you think about, you know, what kind of games you want to make.
And I think starts going into one of our other points, too, about how the different constraints around the accuracy of location and what kind of constraints that puts into the game. So can you build a geocaching with, you know, 100-meter accuracy? Probably not, since you're finding a physical box. Can you do something like a, you know, an island to drop that in at 100 meters? Probably.
Yeah.
So, Mike, in some of your experience, do you want to talk through kind of, you know, how you think different location technologies can, you know, sure, add constraints, remove constraints?
Sure. I think, first of all, the most important thing to remember is that it's all about the game, right? So if you're going to make a game, you can either decide to go to it from the perspective, oh, we're making an interesting game. This is going to be a great experience that people are going to play, that people are going to have, and they're going to use these location technologies in some way to enhance that experience. Or you approach it from the perspective of, okay, so we have a GPS device, what can we do? And I think games which approach, I think if you approach the topic from the technology side, it becomes fundamentally flawed. But when you approach the topic from the experience side and look at the affordances that are available to you, then you can make interesting experiences. And yes, I think fuzzy location is fantastic for games. Like, for instance, with Conquest, we had a city, and we had each city divided into 8 different zones. And then what we did is we just took a range of numbers, and we threw a range of those semicodes into that zone. And so you knew when this team was in the one area, when they were in the zone that they were checked into, they were allowed to shoot that semicode. And so this actually it brought up a whole range of interesting issues, because one of the ways that people cheated in that game, one of the ways they love cheating, was called shoot ahead, I think. Mm-hmm. Did you coin that?
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks. I'll give it to you. And so one of the ways they liked to cheat was they would send out, half the team would go into a zone that they weren't in yet, and they would just go and shoot all the semicodes in that zone. And the normal team would, you know, sit and finish up all the codes in the zone that they were currently in. And then as soon as they checked into the next zone, all the guys that shot ahead would just sit and upload. And so they would just rack up these points really, really quickly. And so in games like that, you can use that fuzzy location for the gamer's benefit and for the benefit of the gameplay. So I think in terms of how these technologies are going to affect games, I think it really depends on the game. So you come up with a great game, like, for instance, Crossroads. Mm-hmm. Again, and Crossroads used GPS technology, and so you had very, very accurate location. But the best part about that was what Dennis mentioned, the non-player character, the Baron. It was having an overlay on top of the real world that only you could see, that you and the other player could see. And so you were engaged in this game, running away from this invisible thing. And that really made the experience special. And I think that would have been a lot harder to do with something like the fuzzy location that we used for the SEM codes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's kind of worth noting the difference between, street games or big games and location-aware games. I mean, Conquest, even though it there's location involved, I mean, there's a map and there's zones and you have to be in a certain zone. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no location-aware technology. It's all kind of faked. It's magic, where it's like, okay, we just drew a map around a specific border and put these particular numbers in there. So the phones aren't smart enough to know where they are, and the kids don't have to check in with like an intersection or say certain things. It's just like, mm-hmm. by shooting a certain code, we can decipher that they're in a given location. So mm-hmm. it's possible to build, I guess, like location, location-based games without having location-aware technology.
Right, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what you did with Pac-Manhattan.
Yeah, it's Pac-Manhattan stuff, the same thing.
Yeah, why didn't you use GPS devices for Pac-Manhattan?
Like, it didn't work. You know, it's like we were trying to run around with laptops in our backpack that would do Wi-Fi triangulation, or trying to get a whole bunch of GPS phones that would work in the same way, and it just didn't work. One of the interesting things to note is like some of these like big like marquee examples, like the Pac-Manhattan stuff, the Conquest stuff, the Crossroads stuff. It's like they're games that get a lot of attention, but they've only been played by a handful of people, mm-hmm. which is not a fault of the designers, the developers. It's just it's very difficult to coordinate a lot of these things. Like Pac-Manhattan, for all the press that it got, like 10 people played it because you have to map out the city, and then you have to have a whole bunch of people up in a tower they can overlook, and everyone's going to have this custom software so they can move these little dots around on a map. I mean, it's a big pain in the ass to coordinate, as is the same with Conquest and even the Crossroads stuff. We had to find a place in Manhattan where the buildings were low enough where a number of phones could all get GPS signals at the same time, and the area had to be shrunk down a little bit. And still, like, we had to control the phones. Like, people can't just show up with their own phones and play. And so one of the things that, Kevin Slavin, the guy with Area Code, it's like, one of his big talking points is, you have to find a way to make location-based games, like, work as easily as, like, Sorry or Monopoly or basketball do. They're just, like, pickup games. There's not all this setup that's involved. It's just kind of you can get out and play. And so maybe, even using, like, the check-in system that the iPhone SDK will now allow, like, it might push that stuff forward because there's a lot of, like, normal people using iPhones. Mm-hmm. They're not, like, niche devices.
Yeah,
you know?
More accessible.
What's that?
More accessible.
More accessible. There's more people like willing to try this stuff. It's more of like an early adopter.
For $400.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, true. But
I think where geocaching is concerned, it's more of a platform that we create. So, I'm more left brain. I don't really come up with the creative ideas for games. You just create the site, create the functionality, and you allow the tools to be available for people to create their own experiences. I think part of that creates more innovative games that you could possibly come up yourself. Is even if you have constraints like just a point, which is geocaching, is basically marking a point in the world, people have created adventure games around it where they create a Mission Impossible game with caches. So you go to one place, there's a satchel. The satchel has a phone number in it. You call this phone number, you get a code. After you say that you're the King of Spain, I called the wrong number on that case, and I think freaked somebody out. But it was really low tech, and it was that person that created it, right down to the point where you had to go to mailboxes, et cetera, with a key and open up a box that had an envelope that you would mail, and then you would receive something back from Mr. Big to find the final cache location. That these weren't things that I created. It was just basically this platform that you create, and then you give them the tools to create it. So if you want to create like a Super Mario kind of game, you create that platform, like Plunder. And you just create those islands and you have the community create it. But the problem is that you have to have critical mass. And when you don't use relative positioning in your game, then you're going to have to find enough people in an area to play, which is why you do a game where you have an event. Mm-hmm. So you know that there's going to be enough people signing up to play. Mm-hmm. So it's just different ways that it took 4 years for geocaching to get critical mass. So if you're willing to be patient, then you might be able to come up with an idea that'll work.
I think one of the things we talked about too was this idea of if you're going to add physical geolocation, you suddenly start dispersing and adding constraint in the amount of density you have for another person to be able to interact with another person. And I think Plunder dealt with that a little bit by making it a casual game, but I think Will, you had some points about some overlays and in terms of.
Well, I think that if you think of it from the sort of design perspective, whether it's like relative sort of location, absolute location, fuzzy location, you start you start thinking about, you know, those as constraints, and you have to start thinking about density as another constraint. So I think these are all kind of things that you can use to think about, you know, what kind of game spaces we're, you know, creating. Like for our game, one of the things we thought about was actually kind of, if you were able to create maps and stuff, then you could actually, you know, have somebody who created a map of, like, you know, Tokyo, and you could layer it on the map of, like, Los Angeles, so that as you're, you know, as you're going through LA, it's like designed in a completely different way, and it's sort of like you're layering spaces on. So I think the idea of, you know, portaling or overlaying, you know, certain spaces onto existing spaces. I mean, you can use location in a really abstract manner. I mean, just even as just like a point matching thing, like you can, you don't necessarily have to think about location specifically as like, okay, I'm here. You
Google
can just
Maps.
Think of it. Yeah. You can think of it as just a data point or something that you can use to have a, you know, a new game idea, or if you have a game idea, thinking about how you can use location to do whatever. Because it's also, you get a whole bunch of information about the environment from location too. So you can think about subtle ways to change game experiences that you may not even really know. It may be a completely virtual electronic game, but if you do a check-in to the location, you could subtly change the game in certain ways just based on, like, you know, there's like environmental sensor networks around the location, or
is it currently raining?
How many, yeah. How many, what's the density of, like, you know, Yelp,
mm-hmm.
you know,
reviews,
reviews and this, like, I mean, just subtle things like that that you could, I mean, there's just a lot of tools at your disposal, not just like this coordinate. It just allows you to, you know, and, yeah.
Dennis, do you have thoughts on that too? I think we, no, I'm going to catch you with food in your mouth.
I didn't even
calling you out.
I was going to say, like, we'll just talk about the different models that we've been talking about here for, like, getting users geolocation.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, like, the crossroads model, where you're running around with your phone and, like, looking at it and relying on the map, and you're requiring some kind of active GPS fix so it can move the dot around the map and you can see where you are in relation to the other things. And then there's, like, which you can do. It's just hard to get that real-time GPS up and running on devices because you have to have specific devices. It just requires a lot of that coordination and a lot of the legwork on the organizer side to get those devices in people's hands. And then there's, like, that check-in model, like the Plunder model, or even kind of like the D-ball model a little bit, dodgeball, where, you know, you're playing and maybe you close the lid on your laptop and you go to another coffee shop and you open it up and then you check in, oh, I am here, or it sniffs out the location of where you are. And then you can put it away. So it's kind of casual, like a little bit passive. You know, you have to initiate the experience every time. Mm. But then there's, and that's pretty easy to do. Like, you can do that with the iPhone SDK. You can do that with, you know, with the Loki SDK stuff. But then there's that third model, which is still super elusive, which is what I need to get some of that, like, skiing and running game stuff working that I was talking about. Which is, you know, as you're walking down the street, like, you step on some invisible X marks a spot, and then your phone buzzes in your pocket. And then it's like, because then you can walk over. Yeah, that's it. You just can't do it. It's like, people talk about it, like, they figured out, I guess, like, the Mogi Mogi stuff in Japan is actively doing that stuff, but I've never been able to, or I've never seen, like, something that works that well in the U.S. And, you know, because it requires that you have a device in your pocket that has GPS running and running in the background, and so, like, it can ping quick enough and not drain the battery, and then also, like, buzz and wake you up when you've walked over something interesting. And it just enables, like, this whole category of very passive games, like games that you take your phone in the pocket, you take your phone in the morning, you put it in your pocket, and you're playing all day long. And if the game wants you to play, it buzzes, and it's like, oh, do something now, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, we're still, I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know how that gets fixed.
That was the original reason that we switched from, I mean, Mob Zombies, like, you know, a few years ago, was actually started off as a GPS game.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of it was like, oh, yeah, it just wasn't any fun. I mean, it was, like, sucked. I mean, it was, like, because, you know, first of all, the resolution is bad, so you have to, you know, kind of, then you're like this little dot, you know, and you're, like,
yep.
You know, just going really slowly across the screen. So that's why, I mean, we sort of changed the relative positioning model, which is, you know, it's super not very accurate. You know, it's like, I say a step, you take a step. I mean, it's not even that accurate. It's like,
what gives the illusion of being
it
accurate?
Gives you the illusion of that model. And I think that if maybe you could make that a little bit better combined with check-ins that happened. I mean, it's almost like the car GPS, where, you know, the car GPS is using, like, all these smart accelerometers and all that kind of stuff to be able to track you. I think that probably the best system for that is some sort of hybrid model where you're actually sort of doing check-ins and you're not, like, always doing stuff, but then you have some sort of model that's happening either on the device or in your, you know, in your pocket that's somehow kind of taking, you know, it's taking intermediate steps to kind of guess about, you know, your location between various points. I mean, that's sort of, like, maybe some sort of model of a potential.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think, you know, before we open it up to questions, one of the big ones I want to go over is lessons learned, right? So everyone here has been dealing with gaming for, you know, some more years than others, but we want to talk about, you know, what works, what doesn't, so people can apply it to either some things you're own doing or even just some of the concepts to, you know, help drive, you know, some community basis or to help build into your own product. So I think maybe just go down the line and talk about what you've seen that works and what doesn't.
Well, I get a lot into the social issues with geocaching, such as littering in, you know, yeah, placing containers out in the world, the Aqua Teen Hunger Force kind of scenario where the bomb squad is called because the cache looks like a pipe bomb, that kind of thing. Those are real issues that you have to deal with. The other thing is, and I think most of the games where you're actually walking around and interacting with something on your phone or your GPS, one of the big issues is that you're looking at your phone and you're navigating without looking up, and that can create some really interesting scenarios. When we created some of our games to test out the idea of creating venture games in the real world, we had to have somebody that watched the cars and made sure that people, right, wouldn't walk out into the street while, right, they're playing these games. So the idea of a vibration, you, yeah, know, that lets you know when you need to look down is a better experience. Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, it'd be great if, say, this GPS unit had Vibrate on it, so it could let you know instead of having you navigate, or you wouldn't use the arrow as much as you might use visual cues, like maybe a picture of a building that you're navigating to. So once you see the picture, you know where to go, and you don't have to look down until it lets you know to access it. So it's, you know, there's the technology side of things, which is always a pain, but there's also the social aspects you really have to consider when you create one of these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I would second that to a degree. I mean, a lot of the the problems we've had is that our experience is totally based on looking down the whole time, like, because it's so, the resolution, you know, the sort of the refresh is so high that it feels very analog, and yeah, and so I think that there, you know, that's something to take into consideration with any kind of location based game or relative game where you're in a virtual world and you're also in the physical world, is you have to somehow let people know that it's like, and it's weird because our experiences, like, with adults and kids were totally different. I mean, like, kids were much more tuned into just being completely absorbed into the virtual space, and they were, like, to the point of being, like, reckless and running into people and stuff like that. And so, whereas adults were much more, like, cautious and careful. And so I think that, yeah, but I think that's a good point. I would second that about figuring out how to, you know, for us it's more about the actual design of the game or the levels or what, and just something that that's making the awareness of the location much more manifest instead of being super peripheral, like, because you have these blinders. So I would second that's a good point.
And then just a quick comment for you guys, because I want to be able to have time for questions.
Oh, lessons learned? Make, yeah, it easy. Make it, like, super simple and super, like, brain dead easy. I think the biggest lesson there is with, I mean, it depends if you're doing an event-based or a pervasive game. Mm-hmm. We tried to do a pervasive game with Superstar Tokyo. It actually was kind of, it lasted for 6 weeks. But because it was so difficult to actually get the game started, it was really difficult to move forward. Conquest was much more successful because everything was in the same place at the same time and everything was organized in terms of having the devices, having the location set up, everything else. That was it.
Two things. If the games are based on devices, like if they exist on the phone, you should, you know, be prepared to hand out phones to people, just because it's very difficult to debug all the experiences unless you have all the devices in front of you. And then street games, like whether it's Pac-Man Hatton or Conquest or any of that stuff, you can put all the, you know, Pac-Man metaphors or GPS technology buzzing in your pocket, you know, over as, you know, as much of that stuff as you want, but it's, you're still playing in the street, and it's really, it's like, they're dangerous, you know. So there's some kind of liability that's built into that, so you'd watch out for that nonsense too.
Cool. I think yeah, we've got the mic there.
Hey, I'm Robin Benefield with Discovery Channel, and had the distinct honor of working with the geo-obsessed minds of Area Code. And they worked on the Shark Runners game that we did, which I just wanted to bring up. You guys have kind of talked about data in terms of streets, very urban, you know, short, you know, blocks and that kind of thing. Have you all been exploring something more like what Area Code did with Shark Runners, with larger amounts of data over, you know, a broader swath of location? So they use the coast of California for tracking sharks, You know, are you looking at kind of other more global locations to use that data and, you know, kind of expand what you're doing in a worldwide way? So there's animal migrations, there's tracking weather, yeah. there's other yeah. ways that GPS, you know, data is out there.
Well, I mean, I haven't done anything directly with that, but I think one of the great things about Shark Runners is that it takes that idea of location and actually applies it. So you're actually, it's sort of location-based, but it was great because you're getting these updates about something that's happening somewhere else in a kind of a real-time fashion. I think that's a real potential, like, an interesting direction for these kind of things.
Well, I'd say my approach is I'm trying to get people outdoors with the stuff that we do, and a lot of the these types of games are like online games where you use offline data to do those kind of experiences. So I haven't really investigated a lot into using data like this. I think it's really cool, but usually we talk about more about having local experts giving information to people to play as opposed to, you know, relative positioning or using data on an online experience. The only kind of online stuff we do is more of sharing experiences when you come back from yeah. Your geocaching trip.
It's interesting that some of the like the real world games, like you have to define this little niche, like this little corner of Seattle that we use for Conquest, or this little corner of the West Village that we used, you know, for Crossroads. But like for something like Plunder, it's just you build it on top of the Google Maps API, and hey, it works on the whole world. Like that's a super super powerful thing, and you get it for free just for just by kind of building it in a smart fashion. So that's just kind of worth noting the distinction between those two games.
Hi, Scott Hacker, UC Berkeley. Jeremy, you don't know this, but you're my hero. Geocaching.com is one of the most amazing database-driven websites and mashup sites that exist, and you guys have been able to do it in ASP as a testament.
We've upgraded to .NET.
Yeah. My question, though, is not gaming-related. I'm actually, I help guide journalists in technology fields, and I think there are, you know, tons of interesting things that journalists could be doing on the web with geodata. Geotagging of photos is an obvious one, but I'm just curious to get the panel's feedback, ideas on ways that, you know, journalists in the field could be gathering geodata and integrate it into their storytelling.
We had a conversation about that last night.
Yeah.
About basically mapping out news articles
yeah.
in such a way that you can learn about over time the kind of things that happen in an area. And I think it comes down to standards, and that each news agency really doesn't have a consistent standard.
They all say they want to do it, and no one ever ends up doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important. I think it's something that it's going to be one of the next kind of good meta layers to put on top of the content. And it's something that people should just start capturing as they go. And I think there's a lot of good movements around, you know, tagging content and, you know, GRSS, that kind of stuff. But I think the more standardized journals need to start adopting it as well. Making it part of what they do and part of how they publish content, not just a city-based tagline.
Can you say more about GeoRSS?
GeoRSS is just a really small standard, kind of an add-on to the RSS spec, where they add either a point or a polygon to each listing. So as you publish out content, if it's geo-related, you add this, you know, one element that's typically a lat-lon.
Mm-hmm.
That way you can start grepping and kind of parsing that content with lat-lon associated. GRSS.org, I think, for anyone else. That,
yeah. Yeah. Do you know Stephen Johnson's Outside In, Inside yeah. Out? Wait, what is it?
Outside In.
Yeah. You're inside. I know. Outside In project.
Yep.
He's here speaking. It's, you know, it's
2 p.m.
It blogs based on GRSS. So you get news feeds around different neighborhoods. You might want to check that out.
Okay,
he's here
great.
Too, so track him down.
There's one other project that just launched recently. Sorry.
I'm done.
So there's a project called everyblock.com,
yep.
which takes a look at that specific issue and maps it down to like a block level. And then they do overlays of many different types of data, which is pretty fascinating.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Johnny Goldstein, johnnygoldstein.com. And, what was I thinking?
Yeah,
so I'm geo-curious. I'm not, like, super steeped in this stuff. But I'm wondering what part of the challenges of doing this stuff are things that could be affected by like the way we regulate or don't regulate communications, telecommunications, or are these all technological problems, or are we lame in our policies somehow as a country in terms of, you know, making this easy or hard?
I think a lot of it, to this point, to Dennis' point earlier too, a lot of it's technologically based, right? If you could have a GPS thing running in your pocket all the time, not having to worry about battery drain, I think a lot of these games might change. Part of it's probably the carriers locking down some of the devices, so it's probably both, but I don't think it's as much a policy issue anymore. I think people are getting more comfortable with it.
If the technology improves, I can definitely see some regulation stepping in. Anything about parental
chicken
advisory explicit lyrics for like the geolocate of games industry? Yeah.
Well, but there's policy stuff just regarding like what resolution of what satellites that there's, you know, GPS satellites are publicly addressable. But that's less of an issue. But I imagine that Michael's right, that as this stuff gets more and more technologically feasible in terms of being able to update your location like this, that they're probably, I don't know, I hope not, but
yeah,
could be more.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, the phones know where they are, like all the E911 stuff, like it has to know in the US at least, it's just the carriers won't give it up. You know, you can get it through like the chipset if you write some code for it, but like they have the data, but they, and it's for a variety of reasons, like liability stuff, they haven't figured out how to monetize it.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the bigger ones.
Definitely.
Masters.
All right, I'm Sylvain Carl. I'm the CTO of a company called Praise Media. I'm, let's call myself, intermediate level geo wanker. So I'd like to know if any of you guys have opinions about the new geoash.org project where they're mapping a lat long to a specific URL. Have you heard of that project? And any
geotudes or which one?
Geohash.org.
I think there's a few of them they're doing. Geotudes is another one too, where they're trying to break it down. I think they're all good things, just helping address different locations, different ways of identifying a location.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I make a distinction between which I call click map kind of location. So you go onto a Google Map, you click on it, and you add a note, and also using a GPS. So you have a more precise location. And I think it comes down to trust of that data, really, and data in general for GPS. Finding a good trust systems to that that URL will relate to this location and how that data was acquired is important. So there's a lot of different ones. I think GeoURL was one of the one of the first ones out there. I hadn't heard of this other one. But.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks.
Hello. Talked a lot about devices and software responding to cities to create games. But I was wondering about how cities might respond to this. And if a city planner or a ski resort owner came to you, how would you make a better game board?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Maybe one of the technologies that really hasn't been discussed and talked about today, strangely enough, is RFID. And so RFID is a valid location technology, and it overcomes many of the constraints associated with GPS, such as power drainage, having to be outdoors, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if we're thinking about how to construct our environments, and a lot of people are thinking about this right now, in terms of location, I think RFID is probably the number one technology that we're going to see emerging in the future because it sidesteps a lot of the problems that we've all been talking about today. And one of the most interesting ways of building a game within, let's say, an RFID-enabled space is one of the most interesting things will be to design and build games within these spaces where you can have indoor location. You can have indoor location, you can have these RFIDs linked to specific URLs, as the question before was just raised.
Yeah, and I think that also means stuff like sensor networks or things like that allow you to kind of get more out of like granular location data. So not just like lat and long, but other things like being able to track altitude, like smog level. I mean, all these kind of things I think are just useful for cities in general, and they'd be good data points for games.
Are you talking
well.
Specifically about like what urban planners can do? Like how can they like mod up the city in order to
have like a more persistent game board?
Yeah. Yeah.
More signals to pick up and locate.
I don't see it as like the planners. It's like there's like a lot of, as you were saying, some of these data sources that you could use for some of these like more games that touch the real world type of stuff. But it's like the infrastructure is already there, but a lot of the stuff is closed. Like some of the cell towers and stuff you just don't have access to do a lot of the stuff. Like it opens up eventually. You know, I was thinking when you said RFID, like the RFID parkour stuff, where it's people just placing these readers around sets up like an obstacle course in a certain sense. I know, but it's nothing to do with planners. It's just people going out and planning these things maybe for other people to use.
I would actually say that that having interesting physical locations that you can interact with in a city.
Yeah.
You know, if I walk around Seattle, there's not a lot of distinctions between blocks to blocks, at least on the ground level, because people don't really pay attention. So you have to take semicodes and put them out there in the world, but if you had more interesting areas to interact with.
Yeah.
I think social and diverse spaces, or, you know, it's areas that are, you know, more open to areas that are more closed. I mean, all those kind of things you think about would be fun to actually design a city based on.
Or
park. Yeah.
That's really important.
Yeah.
And have a relationship
between the
city. Right. Park is great.
Right.
Exactly. Well, the city like combats the skaters, like they go up and they put as much stuff as they can to prevent people from skating there, or, you know, put as many barriers up. Like you don't see that for street games yet. Yeah.
It's a constant battle, I guess.
Well, I think we're out of time, but I want to wrap up really quickly with a few things and just kind of at a tactical level, talk about resources and places people can go leaving here if they want to start playing with gaming and location. I think Where I Go is a great platform, and you can probably plug really quickly where you could pick it up.
Yeah, if you go to whereigo.com, WHEREIGO, or WHRIGO, which is the actual spelling, there's a platform that you can create your own games. It's based on Lua, and it's shared source, so you can go onto some of the experiences that have been created already and download them and see how they work. It's basically taking Zork and bringing it out in the real world, so if you know about adventure games, doing that overlay. And it's similar to geocaching, too, that you have to create this critical mass of, you know, location-based games based on local experts.
And then for anyone who wants to do Plunder-type stuff, loki.com/developers. There's a JavaScript API that you can play with and kind of build your own pervasive casual games.
And the guys at Area Code are doing a lot of just, like, interesting stuff in the space in general, like real-world games and games that use real-world data feeds, stuff that takes place in physical locations. You can check them out at areacodeinc.com.
And last plug is Ware Camp. If you're interested in location, is coming up May 17th and 18th. We're hosting it out at the Googleplex. So if you're geo-curious and want to find out a little more, come down there and we'll probably do a session on gaming. That's where we actually demoed the Plunder stuff. So anyway, thanks a lot for coming down today, guys. Appreciate it.